Have you ever had the opportunity to watch one of those things, maybe on the History Channel, that is really a documentary about war? I find those very fascinating. And what they do is they take a war, let's say they take World War II, and they'll show you what happened during World War II, and they'll show you why that happened. Sort of a behind-the-scenes look about why this general did this, and how this general reacted to what this person did. And it sort of gives you a behind-the-scenes look, and it helps you understand the entire war, and why the war turned out the way that it did. Well, really what the Bible is a lot of things. But one of the things that we have recorded for us in the Bible is we sort of have a behind-the-scenes look at a war that is taking place between God and Satan. And we see how Satan reacts. And then we see how God reacts to what Satan has done. And we see that Satan keeps fighting and fighting and fighting against God. And God keeps stomping him down on every one of his efforts. And he's made promises that he's going to win this war. And we know that he will. This war, the behind-the-scenes look at this war, started way back in Genesis chapter 3. When God created everything, at the end of each day, he said, "It is good." And when God created Adam, he created Adam in his own image. And he gave Adam this wonderful helpmeet, Eve. He put them in this beautiful garden, and he told them that they could eat of every tree except one. And that tree was the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Well, Satan knew that God had a very special relationship with the crowning jewel of his creation, man. And how he walked in the garden. And how there was no sin that separated Adam from God. And the devil acted. The devil takes the form of a serpent and he enters the garden. And he tempts Eve. Eve gives in to the temptation. She takes the fruit of the garden. She eats from the fruit. She gives to her husband and they eat. God is angry. He comes into the garden and Adam and Eve are hiding behind the tree. And they say, "We were afraid and we were ashamed because we were naked. We heard you and we hid ourselves from you." God gives curses to Adam. He gives a curse to Eve. He gives a curse to the serpent, the snake, that Satan used in his battle attempt to hurt God. And then he turns to the devil himself, his enemy, and he says, "Here's what's in it for you. There will always be enmity between your seed and the seed of woman. And one day there will arise from the seed of woman someone who will bruise your head. You will bruise his heel, but he will bruise your head." The rest of the Old Testament, going into the New Testament, is how God makes that happen. But this battle continues to rage. Even though Satan has been told by God in no uncertain terms, "You will not win, there will be a seed of man come to bruise your head," Satan does not give up. He attacks Cain. "There will always be enmity between your seed and the seed of woman." He goes to Cain, and through temptation, he gets Cain to kill his brother Abel. God comes in, and God acts. He takes Cain, and he sends Cain away from the rest of his family, Adam and Eve. Adam has more children. Seth is one of those children. God continues the promise. What was the promise? Way back here in Genesis chapter 3, the promise is, there will be a seed that will come and bruise the head of Satan. God's continuing. Satan's continuing. The battle continues to rage. So much so, when God looks down upon the earth, he sees that Satan has gained much victory. All of the seed of woman has turned corrupt, except Noah. And so when the devil thought he was making headway, "I got everybody in the whole world except this one man, Noah, and his family." God looks down upon this. God knows that his promise is going to come true. And so he stops the devil's attempt right in his tracks, and he cleanses the world of this evil through the flood. So now what does God have? God has a perfectly clean world when it's all over with, the flood is over with. Satan had to be frustrated. Oh, I was making such huge headway. I had every single one of the people on the earth except Noah. Now he started all over with Noah. We know Noah had three sons. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. After the flood, Noah becomes a farmer. He plants a vineyard. He takes of some of the wine from that vineyard, and he becomes drunk. While he is drunk, he becomes uncovered. He has no clothes on in his tent. Ham goes in and sees the nakedness of his father. The other two sons, when they're told about this, they take a sheet, they put it like this, and they walk backward, they cover their father's nakedness, and they leave. They don't turn their head, they don't look on this that they should not be looking upon. And when Noah becomes sober again, he curses Ham, the descendants of Canaan. And he says, "Cursed are you, the descendants of Canaan. You shall serve your brothers. They shall rule over you." To Shem, he says, "Blessed are you. You shall rule over your brothers, the brothers of Canaan, the relatives of Canaan." And to Jephthah, he says, "You shall live in the tents of your brother, Shem, and your brother Canaan shall serve you." See how the story is starting to unfold. Shem's descendants are listed in Genesis chapter 11. And at the end of that chapter, we're introduced to Terah, which is a descendant of Shem, who is the father of Abraham. It is to Abraham this incredible promise that we're going to talk about today is given. And there are three elements of this promise, three points of this promise that we're going to talk about, or three points in our sermon that we're going to talk about relating to this promise. First of all, we're going to look at when the promise was delivered. So we're going to look at when God first gave this promise to Abraham. Then the second thing that we're going to look at is we're going to look at how often this promise is confirmed. And as the promise is confirmed, not only to Abraham, but to Isaac and Jacob, it seems like there's elements each time that the promise is reaffirmed to these gentlemen, that certain things are cleared up, made more obvious to the man that it is made to. It's not something that they understand right away. And just like, remember I talked about that documentary of war? How many people fighting in the war did things and acted, but they didn't understand the whole strategy of war and what was taking place? Almost everybody, right? I don't think Abraham had full understanding of what was going on. He understood partly. God would explain more to him and more to him and more to him, but he knew what he needed to know. But the battle is not about Abraham. And that's one of the points that I want to make, and we'll make it as we go. The battle that is raging is between God and Satan. And there's always going to be enmity between the seed of woman, that would be us, and Satan. There's always going to be that enmity between us. And we have to fight with Satan forever. We're in this same battle, is one point that I want to make. And we have to make sure that we're fighting it on a regular basis. So it's confirmed. And the third point we're going to look at is we're going to look at when that promise is actually started to be fulfilled. And that will be with the birth of Isaac. And that's how God carries it down through to finally gets to Jesus Christ, which is the ultimate promise they made way back there in Genesis chapter 3. So I think as we go through, and so many times people get confused, and I just want to show you the story as it happens from behind the scenes, and as God records it for us, so that we have a better understanding of really the whole, what the Bible is all about, and what the history of the world is all about, and how we come to the point where people are anticipating the birth of Jesus Christ. Why are they anticipating that? Well, you can't know why they're anticipating that until you know what happened in Genesis chapter 3 and until you know what happens in Genesis chapter 12 and some other very important passages that we'll talk about over the next few weeks. So glad everybody is out here today to worship God and to be part of the story that God has initiated way back then, and to make sure that we are part of the winning side. We know there's enmity between the seed of woman, us, and Satan, but we also know that God is the ultimate victor. And so we want to make sure that we are on his side and that we are not on the devil's side. The devil's going to lie to us. He's going to try to trick us. He's going to deceive us. He's going to use every single weapon of war that he has to bring us down. That's what he's all about. That's what he did in the beginning. That's what he continues to do. That's what he's going to do. So we have to be ready. We have to know what's going on and that there is this battle and that we need to make sure that we're on God's side. Let's look at point number one, and that is the promises made. In Genesis chapter 11, we have the history of Shem's descendants. And we come down to Genesis chapter 11 and verse 27 where it says, this is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran begot Lot. And Haran died before his father, Terah, in his native land in Ur of the Chaldeans. Then Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abraham's wife was Sarai. We're going to call them Abraham and Sarah. Okay? Their name gets changed later. It's just so much easier for me if I just call them Abraham and Sarah because that's what I'm used to calling them. And so Nahor also takes a wife. In verse 30, Sarah was barren. She had no children. And Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarah, his son Abraham's wife, and they went out from the land of Ur of the Chaldeans to go to a land of Canaan, and they came to Haran and dwelt there. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Now, Terah was the one responsible that, and he had three sons. He had Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. Those are his three sons. Now, Haran was the father of Lot. Haran died before his father died. That's not natural. That happens sometimes. It seems like it happened more then than it does now. It's not natural. It's not something that we want to happen. But the son died before the father. So then Terah takes responsibility for Lot and really takes him as his own. And eventually Abraham takes responsibility for Lot. Now, Terah was responsible for taking Abram, Lot, and Sarah from Ur to Haran. Now, he didn't go all the way to the Promised Land. Stephen gives us a little more insight into this, but not full insight. And Stephen says that God called Abraham while he was still in the land of the Chaldeans. So either he called Abraham while he was in Ur, and Abraham told his father that he has been called, and then Terah takes that responsibility, believes the message that Abraham has received, or God gave more revelation to Terah that he was supposed to leave with Abraham that we don't have recorded for us. But we know Terah starts this journey away from Ur. He ends up in Haran. Now, there's going to be a chart up here about the... You can't read it very well, but it sort of shows the lineage of Terah. You have Haran over here. He had Lot. We know that Lot bore Moab and Ammon by his daughters, okay? And we have Nahor, Bethel, and then you have Laban and Rebekah are the sons of Bethel. And then we have Leah and Rachel, the daughters of Laban. We know that Jacob comes over here and marries Leah and Rachel. And we know that Isaac comes over here and marries Rebekah. So that's sort of how all the family goes together. And it gives you a little clearer picture of that. Well, it's important for us to bring something else into this point. We don't know a lot about Terah, do we? We do know something. We know he was an idol worshiper, don't we? In Joshua chapter 24... Joshua gathers all of God's people together at Shechem. And this is the famous speech where he says, you can serve the gods that your father served on the other side of the river. What was the other side of the river? Well, it wasn't the Jordan River. It was where Terah came from. Or you can serve the God of the Amorites in whose land you currently dwell. As for me and my house, we are going to serve God. In Joshua 24 and verse 1, then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for the elders of Israel and their heads and their judges and for all their officers, and they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said to all the people, thus says the Lord God of Israel, so it's just like God is speaking at this point, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods. Then I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river, led him throughout all the land of Canaan, and multiplied his descendants and gave him Isaac. To Isaac I gave Jacob, and Esau. To Esau I gave the mountains of Seir to possess. But Jacob and his children went down to Egypt. Also, I sent Moses and Aaron, and I plagued Egypt according to what I did among them. Afterward, I brought you out. I think it's important for us to understand that Terah was an idol worshiper. And so when you look at, in your mind, go back to that chart that we just had up there. When Jacob goes and gets a wife, who does he get? He gets Leah and Rachel, right? When they decide to leave the land after the 7 years and the 7 years and some more years where he worked for Laban, they leave the land. What does Rachel steal? An idol, right? So they were, Terah was an idol worshiper. His brothers would have been idol worshipers. His father was an idol worshiper. Somewhere between there and Shem, idol worship became prevalent in that part of the country among those descendants. But Abraham is not mentioned as an idol worshiper. There's oral tradition that I don't have time to share with you today that's interesting. It's not recorded for us in God's book. It's interesting about maybe why Abraham was not an idol worshiper. But it doesn't show that he's an idol worshiper. His father was, but he wasn't. And so God calls him out of the land. And then in Genesis chapter 12, while they're still in Haran, they didn't go all the way to the promised land while Terah was still alive. He stopped there, he dwelt there, they became rich there. Abraham became rich there. And they don't go to the land, but God calls them again. And the Lord God said to Abram, get out of your country, from your father, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So while he's in Haran, the Lord appears to Abram and tells him to continue his journey down to Canaan. He says, I'm going to give you all of that land. Abraham obeys God. He goes out. Now notice, it's a multifaceted promise. The three elements that we know very well, right? You can ask anybody in our first grade class probably, or a second grade class, or a third grade class, whatever it is. What are the three elements of this promise? Well, we have a land promise, we have a nation promise, and we have a seed promise. And that seed promise we recognize as Jesus Christ, right? So if you think about this for a second, the seed promise is actually connected to one other thing that we've already talked about. It's connected way back here to Genesis chapter 3, right? Where God says, from the seed of woman, I will raise up someone to bruise the head of Satan. So in essence, we know this is a three-pronged promise, but really, in essence, what is it? What's the most important part? It's the seed. The nation is just God's way of getting the seed there for all the world to be blessed, right? That's really all it is. The nation is just God's way of fulfilling the seed promise where all the nations of the world could be blessed. And the land promise is just where that nation is going to live until the seed promise comes out, which is Jesus Christ. Now, many people get distracted by this. They see these three elements of the promise and they escalate or they elevate these other two elements to levels that they don't need to be. In other words, the nation, the great nation, is really the linchpin of the entire Bible. No, it's not. Because you can go all the way, how do I know that? Because you can go all the way back to Genesis chapter 3, and God said nothing about a nation, God said nothing about land, he said something about that seed. So this nation promise is a very important part of God's plan, but it is not the key part. It is just the way he's getting the seed there to bless all of mankind. And we know that seed is Jesus Christ. What started out, now this was one of our blanks last week, but I think this is so key. What started out as a curse on Satan became a promise to Abraham and a blessing to us. And it's a continual thread that goes down through here. The Bible is not just a whole bunch of stories that are just put in there for fun. It's always stories that add to the big story and show the big story. And we can't take our eye off that big story. If we do, we are not going to understand God's full picture. Now, after God makes this promise to Abraham, the land, the nation, and the seed promise, the seed being the most important, Abraham leaves. You know where he goes? He goes to Shechem. Well, we've already talked a little bit about Shechem. that's the place where Joshua calls all the people together and where he says that God promised Abraham this land. It was the same city that Abraham was in when he hears these words from God. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." And there he built an altar to the Lord, and the Lord appeared, who had appeared to him, and he moved from there to the mountains east of Bethel. Bethel's going to come out again in a story, so underline Bethel maybe in your outline. It's going to come up again in just a second. And he pitched his tent from Bethel on the west side of Ai and on the east. And he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. So Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. So as Abraham traveled the land, he was in Shechem, and God reassures him that his descendants are going to own all of this land. All of this land would belong to his descendants. Well, a famine happens. During the famine, Abraham did what was really setting a course of action for whenever the famine had him. Where do they go? They go to Egypt. Abraham goes to Egypt. That's where he lies about his wife being his sister and all that that happens. He comes back out of the land of Egypt, back to his land when the famine is over. And we have where the promise is confirmed. In Genesis chapter 13 and verse 14. And the Lord said to Abram, this is actually after Lot and Abram have separated. And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, "Lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. For all the land which you see, I give to you and your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants also could be numbered. Arise, walk in the land through its length and its width, and I will give it to you." After they separated, God appeared to him again, confirming his promise. Now look, there's one of those, the most important part of the promise is left out here. He says you're going to have a large nation, and you're going to have a large family, and you're going to have fertile land. Now, after that, Lot is captured. We know that story. Abraham gets his guys together. They go out. He gets some help from some allies. They go out, and they save Lot. We're introduced to Melchizedek at this particular point. And then we come to Genesis 15, where God reaffirms the promise again. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield and your exceedingly great reward." Now, all these promises have been made to Abraham, and there's one very important part missing, right? He has no children. He decides to bring that up to God at this point. He says, "Do not be afraid," verse 2, "But Abram said, Lord God, what shall you give me, seeing I go childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? Then Abram said, Look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, This one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir. Then he brought him outside and said, Look now toward heaven." He's already said about the dust of the earth. He tells him to look towards heaven, "Count the stars if you are able to number them." And he said to him, "So shall your descendants be." And he believed in God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Now, after Abraham saved Lot, God appeared to him again, telling him that Eliezer would not be his heir, and that the one that the promise would be carried out through would be his biological son. "It's going to come from you, Abraham. It's going to be your biological son. That's who I'm carrying the promise through." This time, God takes him outside. He says, "Count the stars," and notice that the stars are without number, and that is what your descendants are going to be. If anybody can count all the stars, they're going to be able to count your descendants. And so he's telling him about this great family again, this great nation he was going to have. And that was part of the promise. In the meantime, before our next verse, Ishmael's born. Now, when Sarah, it's her plan, what God say? "Your biological child." So we know it's not Eliezer. Sarah is not able to have children. She's old. So in their mind, they think there's only one solution. The only solution we can come up with in helping God out here is we can give Hagar to Abraham. Hagar goes into Abraham. Hagar becomes pregnant. When she becomes with child, she's despised by Sarah. Sarah sends her away. Actually, she doesn't send her away. She just goes away this time. So she's out there. An angel of the Lord appears to her and says, "You're with child." go back and do what Sarah tells you to do. Well, God is going to come to Abraham again and clarify a little bit more about this promise. In Genesis 17 and verse 5, it says, "No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham, for I have made you father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you." And when we studied in Genesis, our last time in Genesis, we looked at all the different nations that came from Abraham, other than just Israel, or numerous nations. Verse 7, "And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you in their generation for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. Also, I will give to your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan as an everlasting possession. I will be your God." In this case, Abraham laughs. Okay? God goes on to confirm this again to Abraham, and he gives him a sign of the covenant at this point. And we know the sign of the covenant is circumcision. Now, in the reading that we had read for us this morning, God blesses Sarah at this point and tells Abraham that the nation and the seed promise would be fulfilled through Sarah. So first of all, he says, "Through you all the nations of the world will be blessed." Abraham had no children, so he says, it must be Eliezer. He tells God that Eliezer. God clarifies, no, it's through your biological seed that this is going to happen. And so they have this whole thing with Ishmael. And then God comes down again. No, it is through Sarah that this is going to happen. And before Sodom is destroyed, God comes and visits him again. Genesis 18 and verse 10. He said, "I will certainly return to you according to the time of life. And behold, Sarah your wife shall have a son." Sarah was listening. You ever listening and put her ear up at the tent door? I don't know if she had a cup there or what she was doing, but she was definitely eavesdropping. She wanted to know what was taking place. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age. And Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, "After I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?" And the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I surely bear a child since I am old?'" And here's a very important verse. "Is anything too hard for the Lord?" Jesus uses that same about a rich man going to heaven. With man, it's impossible. With God, all things are possible. Okay? "Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son." But Sarah denied it, saying, "I did not laugh." And he said, "Yes, you did laugh." When God appears to him again, he confirms that the son of promise would come through Sarah. This time, instead of Abraham laughing out loud, Sarah laughs inside. Well, there's another famine. Isaac is old now. We're advancing. Isaac is a grown man now. We're going to come back to Isaac in a second. We're just going to fast forward to our story for a second, okay? So Isaac is older now. There's a famine, and we're talking about how God is reaffirming this promise. So he's talking to Isaac now. "Then the Lord appeared to him and said, 'Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land of which I tell you. Dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father, and I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws.'" So God, when he's telling Isaac this three-part promise, he says this is happening because of Abraham's obedience. We already looked at the passage that said it was considered as obedient, counted as righteousness to Abraham, his obedience. He believed God and was counted as righteousness. Well, then it's affirmed again to Jacob in Genesis chapter 28, verse 13. "And behold," this is the ladder, the dream. "And behold, the Lord stood above it and said," this is the ladder, "I am the Lord God of Abraham your father and the God of Isaac, and the land which you lie I will give to you and your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. And in you and in your seed all the families of the earth will be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. Do you know where Jacob had that dream? Bethel, the house of God, which goes back to our story. I told you to underline the story there where God appeared. After he appeared to him at Shechem, he goes to Bethel. See, all this is happening in the same place, in the same cities, and it's being told over and over and over again. Jacob gets the same promise that through his seed, all nations of the world would be blessed. All right, now we're going to hit the rewind button in our story, and we're going to go back to Genesis chapter 21, and we're going to look at where this promise started being carried out. We know that Eleazar wasn't it. We know that Ishmael wasn't it. How is God going to carry out this promise to a woman who is 90 and to a man who is 100 that it is evident are well beyond the years of childbearing? They know it. God knows it. The whole world knows it, right? And this is going to be a phenomenal, amazing thing. Is anything too hard for God? No. I mean, can you imagine 100 years old, giving up hope that you would ever have a children? You're believing God. He promises you this, so you do believe him. But what's the rest of the world going to think? And there's sort of extra joy in this because of what happens here. In Genesis chapter 21, verse 7, and the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time in which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. When Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, now Ishmael was 13 when he was circumcised, Abraham was a grown man, as God had commanded him. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me. So everybody laugh. It's an amazing story. It's funny, and in a way, it's an amazing story that God gave a woman 100 years old a child, partly to show that he can do anything. Behold, I am with you. Well, where am I here? I'm in verse 7. So she also said, who would have said to Abraham and Sarah would nurse children? For I have borne him a son in his old age. Now, notice this. The first son of promise entered the world to much excitement and fanfare. Could you imagine the party that they threw when Isaac was born? I mean, this would have been amazing. They would have called all their friends together. They would have told the story. Sarah, I can just imagine them all sitting around. This is unbelievable. Sarah has had, they tell a story. Sarah? Sarah's 100 years old. What do you mean Sarah's had a baby? Sarah's 90, Abraham's 100 years old. You're not telling me the truth. Could you imagine everybody coming to hear this and the excitement that was there? This was a son of promise. And since his parents were well beyond the childbearing years, his birth brought special blessings. I mean, her womb was closed. She had given up hope except this promise, right? And this is a major deal that God came and allowed this to happen to her. When the seed promise is finally fulfilled, Jesus comes into the world in shame. Abraham's son of promise, Isaac, comes into the world with excitement. Look at what God has done. The real son of promise comes into the world to a girl who is not married. Most of the world did not believe in the virgin birth at that time. And they would have viewed Mary as a terrible, terrible young lady. And a lot of people probably thought it must have been Joseph, because if it wasn't Joseph, Joseph would have left her there. And so these two young people brought Jesus into the world to great shame. How much fanfare was there from the world? I mean, we have angels, we have wise men, we have a lot. But do we have this great excitement from the family and from all those who are around? No. Isaac enters the world to rich parents. When Abraham was in Haran, it says when he left with exceedingly many riches. We know that they were so rich that the land could not support Abraham and Lot, right? They had to separate because they were so rich. When Jesus enters the world, when the seed promise actually does come, he enters to poor parents. And there's no place for him to put his head. There's no inn. There's no huge house. There's no anything for him at that point. As a matter of fact, when they offer up the sacrifices, they offer up turtle doves and birds because they're poor. Do you see? Are you starting to see why Simeon, when he looked into the eyes of this baby Jesus, how he said, "I can die in peace now because I've seen the consolation of Israel"? The birth of Jesus is not fully understood if you start reading in Matthew. The excitement, the importance of his birth is not fully comprehended unless you go back and get a good grasp of what the Old Testament is all about. And that's what we're trying to do. Starts in Genesis chapter 3, where God says, "The seed of woman will arise and bruise the head of Satan," the one who has just robbed me of this fellowship that I have with mankind. Jesus is the one that's going to restore that fellowship. After that Genesis 3, you come to Genesis chapter 12, where you have the promise, and it's repeated in chapter 15, chapter 22, and some other places. You have that promise that through your seed, Abraham, I'm going to fulfill what I said back there. All the nations of the world are going to be blessed. And that blessing takes place through the, not really the birth of Jesus, but the death of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus is how that is accomplished. The death of Jesus is the bruising of the heel. The resurrection of Jesus is the bruising of Satan's head. We talk about Bible stories a lot, and I love Bible stories. They're the most amazing stories ever. They're true stories. That's what makes them partly what makes them amazing. But do you realize, although the Bible is finished, do you remember, do you think about this every day, we're still in God's story? The Bible story is finished. God's story is not finished. You're in God's story. And so the question for you today, what role are you playing in God's story? Are you on his side? Are you obedient like Abraham was? Every story in the Bible illustrates that we have to obey God. You can't read it without coming to that conclusion. Every story illustrates you have to obey God. Are you obedient to God? Have you done what God wants you to do? Or do you live your life without God, without thought of God, just floundering around in this story aimlessly? If you're doing that, you may not be on God's side. It takes thought to be on God's side. It takes a decision. Choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods that were served by your fathers on the other side of the river, Terah and the others, or the gods who are in the land today. But as for me and my house, we make a decision to serve the Lord. Every individual person has to make that decision. If you've never made that decision, you can make it. If you don't know how to make that decision, we'll be glad to talk to you about that. And if you've made that decision, but you've gone back and allowed the devil to separate you from God again, and that's of a public nature, you can make that right. But as we stand and sing, everybody is going to commit to be on the Lord's side and have victory in Jesus right now.